It is my pleasure, after a brief absence, to welcome back to the show one of our favorite regulars, David Murata, president of Murata Wealth Management. David, thanks for joining us here on The Shilling Show.
Thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to your new two-hour format so we can get into politics a little bit more.
Well, it's terrific, and there's lots and lots to talk about today. First of all, you are going to be speaking tomorrow. You are one of the featured speakers at the Tea Party. And I'd like to know if you could tell the audience why you're interested in this event and what does it mean to you?
I saw the event because a number of small business owners that are clients of ours are interested in how they can reduce the burden that continually gets placed upon them. And the one of the organizers of the event wrote a nice note to me and said, actually wrote a nice note on the blog, which said, if you avoid the struggle for freedom and liberty and lower taxes and limited government, long enough it will be too late. And so I thought it would be great to go out and support the event. We write about tax freedom this time of year,
right?
And it's just nice to have something to do more than just write about it, but to actually begin to get a little bit of that righteous indignation and anger and ask for action about it.
I think it's great because it's really focusing the community, and there are so many people who were individually disturbed by all that's going on in the country today. This is particularly focused on taxation and governance, but I mean it really goes beyond that. I think this is really only the beginning of what will be coalitions formed by people across the country and here locally on this issue and others.
Yeah, what I think is amazing is that small business owners represent the majority of individuals who make over $250,000, on whom we're placing all of the burdens of society. And at the same time, small business owners are responsible for 120% of job growth. Yes, 120%, because large businesses consolidate, and so small businesses are the ones who are expanding. And so on whom all of the recovery burden is being laid, we're also laying all of societal's burdens at the same time. And it's not true that that is without consequences. That has consequences. And so there's a phrase from Ayn Rand's book, Going John Galt, which means basically the captains of industry take a hiatus from their work and they basically go on strike. And if that ever happened, you know, the top 5% of our country pays 60% of the taxes. The rest of the society would completely collapse. But it doesn't have to be a coordinated effort to go John Galt. It's simply the natural consequence of taxing that group more. They will do less in the economy.
And it's amazing. And of course, you're speaking of Ayn Rand's book, and I just got a copy of it and have dug in myself after years of being aware of it, thinking that now was the time to read that. And we do recommend people to check that out. There's so much to talk about today, and people may have seen your article. You write every Monday in the business section of the Daily Progress. People have read you there for years, I think about 10 years. And let's talk about earmarks, because this is a critical topic when we get into the whole issue of government and governance. First of all, let's define, what is an earmark? There seems to be some confusion, at least by our congressperson.
Yeah, an earmark is something which is specifically tied to a particular congressman. They are the sponsors, and they are the ones whose district benefits from it. And if you will, it's sort of a way of bribing congressmen to vote for the other 98% of the budget by giving them some things that are specific to their district. And usually these are the things that they can use within the community to say, I will support these earmarks within the community if you will support me in reelection. And so it's very much a corrupting influence in our political life.
You know, I saw it even on the local level as I served, and I saw the other counselors handing out money and buying votes with taxpayer money, and even going so far, I remember one meeting, I will never forget it. We were talking about the so-called council reserve, and this is a little money that the city manager sets aside for the council to spend and greases their palms so that they can grease the palms of the community, and then they'll give him a nice raise. And one counselor referred to it as my play money. And I was so offended by that as a counselor and as a taxpayer. But this is the way that many people in government look at taxpayer money, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say the majority of Americans today don't really believe in limited government. They don't believe in personal freedom. They believe that this grease is just what smooths government and makes it work. And I think if we had that in any other organization, I mean, for example, if someone called in here and offered you $30 to change your opinion on the air and start saying something different, there should be an outrage in that. And if you were pushing certain agendas simply because you were being bribed to do it, who would stand for that? That would be a horrible scandal. And yet in government, that's exactly what happens. It's touted, it's put forth with pride, and it's a corrupting influence.
It certainly is. When I was talking with my wife this morning about our conversation and she had read your article, she wanted to know if you know, what is the history of these earmarks and if they've been with us since the beginning of the country? And if not, when did they come into play?
That's a great question. And I've just been reading David McCulloch's biography of John Adams, which I recommend to anyone who's interested. And John Adams talks about government is always grasping for power. And his biggest fear was exactly what's happening today, and that is that limited government would not remain limited, but that government would continue to grasp more and more for power. It's amazing to me that over a simple tax like the tea tax or the Stamp Act, our country was willing to go to war in the 1700s, and yet today, with taxes that are much more intrusive and government which is much larger, no one's willing to stand for it. I think it's the gradual creep of more and more government power being in the hands of fewer and fewer and putting the burden on a smaller and smaller number, so that 50% of the population is willing to vote for it because it doesn't cost them a dime. And among the other 50%, it's paid for by mostly that last 5%. And so everyone else says, well, it doesn't cost me that much, and so I'm willing to vote for it too. But I don't know the history of earmarks. I just know that they've been increasing in recent years to greater and greater heights.
And it's becoming so obvious now. You know, in talking about the definition of an earmark, Congressman Perriello had sent out a justification press release about why he voted for H.R. 1, the stimulus bill, which was loaded with pork. But this is something that I found incredulous. He talked about it being a serious step toward transparency, which I thought was preposterous because he himself had written a letter to Nancy Pelosi saying, you're not doing what you said and putting it up for 48 hours for people to look at. And then he voted for it anyway. So it wasn't transparent. He said, this set up a public process for submitting the proposals and identified cost-effective and transformative projects. And then he says, and this is the part I really take issue with in his press release, he said, but I've got to be willing to put my signature on any request we submit. That was a different press release. But he went on to say in the original press release, the vast majority of this bill goes directly to tax relief and to support our state and local governments without any federal earmarks, quote unquote, Tom Perriello. How could our congressman or any congressman make such a statement? Do you agree with him that there are no federal earmarks in the stimulus bill in H.R. 1?
Well, it's interesting. Earmarks has a technical definition, and by the technical definition of an appropriation specific to one congressman, it could be true that there's no earmarks. But most people, when they read that and there's no earmarks, they think there's no pork. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of pork, and the pork is projects anyway. So earmarks is a very small section with a legal definition in Torah according to Congress. And it is what bribes people to vote for the other pork, which then has its own consequences and ability to be used politically. And then there are the entitlement programs, which is what gains the 50% of the vote of the people who pay nothing in taxes. And so in each case, I mean, we used to have taxation without representation. Now we have 50% of the population has representation but no taxation. So they vote for everything. And it's impossible to stop that tide until a majority of people who actually are paying the taxes get a little righteous indignation and actually say, we will not stand for this. This is going to be a revolt. And that's the thing that made me want to come out for the Tea Party, is that I know the other side is vehement. They have a fire in their belly to tax the rich and to redistribute wealth and to have government increase. And if we are not willing to have a fire in our belly, all the ink on the Constitution is just dried ink. It means nothing. Limited government means nothing. Our history means nothing. And the country swings. It swings like a pendulum. And when it swings too far one way, like it has now, the other side says, wait, hold on, stop. It's something's got to give on this. You have to correct this. This has gone too far. And I think most Americans, when they look at the bailouts and the takeover of of various banking systems and trying to determine, fire CEOs and determine what compensation is going to be given to people. I think they say the government's gone too far on that. That's a mistake. There's something wrong with that.
I hope so. We're talking with David Marotta. His website is emarotta.com. That's emarotta.com if you'd like to check him out online. And I guess the thing that I worry about is that we've reached the tipping point. I certainly think it's happened in Charlottesville, where the taxes got so high that the government finally came in and said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to tax people even more and then give that money back to people who can't afford to pay their taxes. So they now have people who previously were opposed to them being beholden to them to get tax, quote unquote, tax relief and get a tax rebate. It seems that we've reached a tipping point in the country where people, more people are on the dole and are getting things and are not willing to stand up and say this is too much because they're scared to threaten what they're getting from the government.
Yeah, Milton Friedman wrote something called The Fragility of Freedom at 60%. And in that article, he said when a majority of the people gain their livelihood from government's spending and government taxation, it's very difficult to stop the vote. And so I think you're right. We are at a tipping point, and it could go one of two ways. And that's why I'm coming out tomorrow, is because I'm really hoping it doesn't go away into the slide of the socialism of Europe, because that's pretty much been proven to not produce productivity.
It's been a failure. And I guess the other thing that scares me as we head into the break here is that, you know, the largest employers in the area are the city, the county, and the university, to my understanding. And so you've got a lot of people dependent on local government. And that buys votes. It's 12:28 here on The Shilling Show. David Marotta will return right after the news. Stand by.
Giving voice to the voiceless. It's Rob Shilling and The Shilling Show on News Radio 1070 WINA.
And all points of view are welcome here on The Shilling Show. Agree or disagree, if you think these earmarks are serving a good purpose, we would love to hear from you at 977-1070 as we continue the conversation with David Marotta. And a little secret I just am going to let you in on right now. I'm not going to mention it too many times, but every caller who goes on air today with us will have a free oven-baked sandwich from Domino's Pizza. We will have a little prize for our loyal calling audience today. That's a $5 value. Every caller who goes on the air with us in this hour and the next one, we'll get a free oven-baked sandwich, courtesy of our friends at Domino's, and we like to treat our audience whenever we have the opportunity. So when you call in, just tell Leon you're interested in that at 977-1070, and we'll give it to you and make sure that you have that. So we were on this whole topic of earmarks, and there's so much to talk about. I know we're going to run out of time, but what percentage of the budget are earmarks? Because it may sound insignificant to some, but it's really not, is it?
Yeah, no, people say they try to defend the practice of earmarks, and the first thing they say is it's only 1.9% of the budget. But you have to understand, 1.9% of a $410 billion budget means that every single representative in the House has about $18 million in earmarks that they can spend on average and give to various organizations in order to try to solicit political support. You know, in comparison, bonuses at AIG were given to 400 employees, and only 7 of them received more than $3 million. In contrast, every representative in the House has $18 million. So that's amazing. It's a bigger amount of money than the local perpetrator of our local Ponzi scheme. It should be a scandal that our representative is trying to throw around $18 million. And not to be outdone, our local representative requested $159 million in earmarks. So he didn't even limit it down to his share of 18. He's requested $159 million. And I would love to see a caller call in. I looked over the list of 52 different earmark requests.
Yeah.
And I could not find one among the group that I thought worthy of the taxpayer support.
Well, maybe somebody out there would like to defend that, and we have a line open for you right now at 977-1070. And Gary is on line number one. And Gary, thanks for calling The Shilling Show. You are on with David Marotta.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, David. David, appreciated the article, particularly in this week's Charlottesville Business Journal. And you referenced one point where you, of course, quoted from, you know, when you're doing the, I guess, the articles with your dad about Japan. And I wanted to ask you if you could explain to us what's called the lost decade what happened in Japanese economic policy in what's called that lost decade, which is fairly, I think it was the 1990s, and what implications that might be for our policies here in the United States.
Yeah, the very first column I did, I co-authored with my father in the Charlottesville Business Journal. This is back in the fall of 2002 when the Charlottesville Business Journal was a free newspaper. It was before the Daily Progress even picked it up. And the title of the article was, Will the U.S. Go the Way of Japan? And the fall of Enron was fresh in everyone's mind. And our answer to that question was no, because in the U.S. we allow companies to go bankrupt when they cannot succeed in business. But in Japan, both banks and corporations that are bankrupt are allowed to continue and drag down the economy. The ruthless culture that allows large companies to go bankrupt in the U.S. hurts less in the long run than the Japanese style of business subsidies. So in the U.S., the government keeps its hands off business. In Japan, the government interferes with operations and business and commerce, and that's why Japan had a decade, even longer. They're still trying to recover because their economy was drained by the constant trying to bail out of companies that we should have just let gone under. Was Enron too big to fail? No, clearly not. You know, a couple of years later, no one even thought about Enron. Are the companies today too big to fail? The banks? No, they are not. In fact, they're too big to subsidize for the next decade and try to bail out. So it worries me more with the current administration trying to dabble in banking. They have no idea what they're doing. They're not qualified to do it. They couldn't even oversee Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They were responsible for those. Those were government organizations. They couldn't run those well. In fact, those helped bring down the banking industry, which they're now trying to take over. And when government takes over corporations and starts trying to run corporations to the detriment of all the other corporations, that's called fascism. That's what fascism is. And I think it's okay to use the word fascism because that's exactly what it means at this point. And that's never a good thing. And the problem, this is nothing against partisan politics. This has nothing to do with the Democrats or the Republicans, because the Democrats and the Republicans are both at this point emphasizing a large government. And this is trying to represent a small government. And so a small government will, in the end, allow the strength of America, which is its working world, to actually pull ourselves out of what is a government-induced meltdown.
Okay, thanks, David. Listen, let me one quick follow-up question. With all these takeovers of the banks, are we getting anything from it? I mean, are there any stocks being exchanged, any IOUs, or is it just a complete, here's a check, go spend it?
You know, if the government is getting something out of it, to me it would be worse than if they're not. And I think they are getting something out of it. So, for example, when the government bails out Ford and General Motors, it is to the detriment of thousands and thousands of workers who work at the Toyota plant in the South, who is making money, who is making good cars, who's making the cars that people want to buy. And GM and Ford do not deserve to be bailed out simply because they started as American companies when we have other companies building cars in the U.S. employing people. How do you compete? If I'm a bank, how do I compete with the government? The government has unlimited resources. They can lend money at a loss. They can so all it does is it weakens all of the banks which are good and solvent. It weakens the rest of the economy. And what's going to happen is the government does have a stake in these banks. And now that the government has a stake in these banks, if these banks are not successful, it's a scandal. And when these banks are successful, it will be the detriment of everyone else. And pretty soon, the only part of the country which has stable employment is going to be government-run corporations. Because every time you stabilize one part of the economy, you do it to the detriment of weakening every other part of the economy. And so it's actually worse if the government is not simply bailing them out and taking a stake of ownership, because now they're going to want to get something back from that. So I have no doubt that in the end, the government will actually make money off of all of these ventures, but that's not the role of government, to compete with the private market in an unfair environment. That's what got us into the problem of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the first place. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could loan at lower interest rates with a higher guarantee of the loan than anyone else because they were backed by the federal government.
Okay, thanks, David.
Gary, thank you very much for the call. That leaves a line open for you right now at 977-1070 if you have a question or comment for our guest, David Murata. So this whole thing is very interesting. And I'm wondering if you think, you know, from your own perspective, and you've been in this business for a long time, do you think this is by design? In other words, are these politicians stepping in because they would like to see the nationalization of industry in the United States, or are they just naive and stepping in because they think, well, we have to do something?
Yeah, it's interesting. The cynic in me says government creates the problem in order that government might have its power creep, because it's always grasping for power. The more charitable side of me says that they are simply trying to respond to crises. And when you want to respond to a crisis, you don't want to be the one who's blamed for it, and you want to be the one who helps bring about the solution. And so when people clamor for government to do something, it's the people who I hold at fault even more than our government officials. The United States government still has power in the hands of the people, and when those people cede that power to the government and look for the government to solve their problems, it is almost always worse than if they look to how they can solve the problems themselves. So that there's a part of me that's charitable, and I think there are some large government advocates who are simply naive, maybe the majority. There's a part of me that's cynical, and there are some large government advocates who I believe know exactly what they're doing and are very good at manipulating power and gaining power.
News Radio 1070, WINA 977-1070 is the phone number. If you have questions or comments for David Morata, our guest, at 1243, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with your calls at 977-1070. You know, all points of view are welcome. Stand by for more of The Shilling Show. All right, coming up in the next hour of The Shilling Show, just to let you know, Ken Boyd is going to be in the house. If you have questions or comments for Ken, you can call us in hour number two today, and there is much to talk about on the county level as well. We're continuing conversation, though, right now with David Morata, and let's see here. We have missing in action for a long time, but back on The Shilling Show. Minister of Seoul, where have you been?
Rob, I've been busy, but I'm listening in here. I just got on listened to you about last 5-10 minutes. I don't know David's background, but I do know my background, and that includes 15-20 years ago, I was doing real estate loan workouts in Boston during the S&L crisis. More recently, 10 years ago, I was working for a major bank in Richmond doing small business lending. And I have seen this crisis coming for 20 years, and it's ridiculous. There's plenty of blame to go around, Republicans, Democrats, big business. And basically what's happened on Republicans and Democrats is, you know, the Republicans were in charge of the banking committees in the House and Senate for a number of years. They did nothing. They let the Democrats fool around with the Fannie Mae, you know, Freddie Mac. I think Chris Dodd and Barney Frank should have resigned. They're a disgrace. They've let this thing get out of control. And in fact, I think that all the congressmen and senators who were in office more than 6 years should have been replaced, should have voluntarily resigned as a disgrace that they let this financial debacle occur. Now, on the business side, essentially the deregulation of the banking industry with the replacement of Glass-Steagall allowed large banks like Bank of America, Citicorp, and et cetera to basically get out of control and dumb down the whole lending area. They basically replaced people who had credit background and knowledge of banking with a bunch of customer service people who all they could say was yes, yeah. i.e. sales, no credit. So there's plenty of blame to go around.
Yeah. Would you agree that not every bank was as bad as certain banks?
Yes. I think the only saving grace is the small banks, such as the BB&T or your small community banks, who, thank God, weren't involved in all this damn, it's basically gambling. That's what those guys in Wall Street were doing, gambling.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous.
And I would say Charlottesville has too many banks currently. Let's let the bad ones go under, and let's let the good ones stay.
You're right.
Yeah, it's a lot less painful in the long run than subsidizing the big ones so that they now are stronger than the small ones, because they had all the benefit of reckless lending on the front end, and then they had absolutely none of the consequences on the bad end.
You're right. I think, they should, the federal government, rather than bailing out Citicorp, Bank of America, and all these other banks, just let them fail, let the chips fall where they may. And you know what? Everybody will be a lot more conservative. There won't be so much speculation in real estate and in investment banking and all this stuff, and we'll all be better off.
Yep, and then we won't go the way of Japan.
Indeed. You're right. That's exactly the big fear.
Minister of Soul, it is great to hear from you. Please don't be a stranger to the Shilling Show, and we welcome your return here. We've been missing you. So thanks very much for the call. Very good points. Lines open for you right now at 977-1070. If you have questions or comments here in the last segment with David Murata, and Hal is on line number two. Hal, thanks for calling the Shilling Show.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm kind of skeptical about having an open book policy for, giving as much money as possible to the banks as whatever it takes. And I have an alternative idea. Why not, instead of just having this open book, limit the bailout to just some percentage of buying the toxic assets of certain banks, and maybe just reward the banks are still healthy if that's what, and let the other banks fail for their misdeeds, and then turn those debts over to the IRS and let the IRS deal with the taxpayers, and they can renegotiate it, whatever. That way you limit the government involvement, you free up credit for the banks, you leave the banks alone, you let them stabilize themselves, and the government stays out of their business.
Yeah, and let me ask a question. You said government stays out of the business, but why would you turn the toxic assets over to the IRS for collection?
Because they're the meanest sons of bitches in terms of collection agency in the world.
Yeah,
interestingly
enough, though, when I get a loan for a house, I put up as collateral my down payment on the house, mm-hmm. and if I no longer want to make those payments, I walk away from it, and you foreclose on the house. I think for millions of Americans, walking away from the house or declaring bankruptcy is the right solution. They are insolvent. They have overstretched. And in this company, we have bankruptcy laws for a reason, because bankruptcy laws are better than debtor's prison. Bankruptcy laws are better than IRS prison, too. And so I would say that the banks took the risk of loaning to people they shouldn't have loaned to for whatever reason they did, I think spurred on by the Consumer Reinvestment Act. But for whatever reason they did or were forced to do that, they now own the asset of the house. So when someone walks away from their house and it's been foreclosed on, they own the house and they now own a piece of property. You don't need the IRS involved. That's all a private transaction matter. And if they can't collect on an asset or someone is insolvent, they can walk away from the asset or they can declare bankruptcy. So I wouldn't even try to collect on a loan for somebody who's walked away from their house. That's actually the way the loan works.
Yeah, I understand that, and you make a good point. If the house doesn't have an owner except the government, there's nobody to collect from. So
right. And the interesting thing on the toxic assets is that at this point, the government, if I'm trying to figure out what is this asset worth, so I'm trying to figure out, I've got 1,000 homes in Michigan, and I'm willing to pay, maybe I'm an investor, I'm willing to pay 20 cents on the dollar because I know that most of these homes have been walked away from, the plumbing is broken, the mold is there. Maybe they're worth 20 cents on the dollar, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute the government steps in, I know I can predict how many are going to get foreclosed and how many they're going to make their payments. I can predict that. But the minute the government steps in and says, no, we're going to cram down the interest rate and we're going to force you to take something different than the contract, now all of a sudden I have three options and I don't know what that third option is or how much they're going to cram it down. So the toxic assets, I can price those even if the price is really low. But the minute the government steps in and says, no, you're not going to get the house and you're not going to get your payments, you're going to get a third of your payments and that's all, because we're going to force it through the court system, even overriding a private contract, now I don't know what I can pay for it, and now I don't want to buy it. And so a lot of banks are not willing to touch these toxic assets because of the political risk of Congress, who's going to say, you get neither the house nor the payments, you get something else, and we're going to determine what it is.
All right. And Hal, thank you very much. It was an excellent call. And you know what my fear is, David? And you tell me if you think I'm off base here. Here's my fear, because I'm more on the cynical side when you were talking about people knowing what they're doing. I think that the federal government is going to take charge of a lot of these houses, and then they are going to grease the palms of the state and local, particularly local governments like Charlottesville, and say, here, we have all these houses. Now you administer them as affordable housing. And now we have all these other people who are now beholden to the government because now their housing is coming from the government. Do you think that's a far-fetched idea?
No, the cynic in me says you're exactly right, that they will take whatever asset they can get, including a toxic asset, and somehow turn it into a boon in a way to gain political power.
No doubt about it. It's 12:54 here on The Shilling Show. You know, we've got about a minute left to talk about this, and we never got to most of what I wanted to get to today, but it's been a great hour with you. You have been in the investment business for a long time. You understand investments. So when I saw our Congressman Perriello say, I'm eager to find investments that create real value and economic development in our communities, when speaking about these expenditures, is that an investment?
You know, if it's worth the money, if it's going to gain more than it costs, then private enterprise would have done it. So everything on the list of appropriations, first of all, they are all government agencies and nonprofits who receive it. So not one person who's receiving an earmark in the $159 million that our representative is trying to give away, not one of those pays a dime in taxes. So it's really difficult to say this is going to somehow be a valuable use of taxpayer funds when none of these are actually going to benefit anyone who pays taxes.
We will leave it there. David Morata, we will see you tomorrow at the Tax Day Tea Party, 3 to 6 on the Downtown Mall at the Pavilion. Looking forward to what you have to say. And it's good to have you back on board as a regular guest. We'll look forward to this conversation next month.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much.